The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is Dan Krall in the echoey chamber of the First United Methodist Church along Monroe, and I am joined by Craig Hansen, who is the organ player here at this very majestic open space.
Good morning, everyone. I'm happy to welcome you to this radio program.
As we are recording this, Craig is getting ready to play at 12:15 today, as I record this on Wednesday, as he does every third Wednesday of the month for a free concert at 12:15 p.m. at the Methodist Church, where he plays this very majestic, booming organ that is before us as we record. How long have you been doing this?
I've been playing at the church since 2007, January 2007. I've been doing this series since April of 2011, so quite a few years.
And how long are these concerts?
The concerts are typically 30 to 40 minutes, and we have one every month, so 12 a year. And then we also have larger productions where we invite brass ensembles or string quartets along with the organ. We have that once or twice a year. And yes, the concerts are 30 to 40 minutes long. The evening concerts, usually on Friday evening, are an hour and a half long. So.
What selections are you playing today as we record here in mid-October?
I'm playing works by a French Baroque composer, Nicolas de Grigny. And he was actually very well known back in the day. Bach, in fact, copied all of his music by hand. And they didn't have, obviously, copy machines back then, so if you wanted music, you had to write it all by hand. But that's over 100 pages of his works that Bach copied out.
Is he among your favorite composers?
I don't know about that. He is a great composer. I wouldn't say he's among my favorite, but...
Who is your current favorite? Who's your number one?
That is so hard to say, but probably Bach is the father of modern music. So, yes, I would say Bach is my favorite.
Great. And what is the name of the piece that will open today's concert?
Well, I am playing a series of... pieces from a mass. So it's called Dialogue sur les grands jeux. It's a dialogue with loud trumpet stops. Yeah, a dialogue between two different timbres or two different sounds on the organ.
Very good. Well, if listeners want to know more about this concert series, is there a website they can visit to get more information?
On the First United Methodist Church website, they have a little information about the concerts and about the organ, which is a really wonderful instrument. They have how many stops it has and how many pipes it has and this kind of information. So I encourage you to go have a look if you have time.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I'm looking forward to this free concert here in the auditorium of the First United Methodist Church along Monroe, here in Corvallis, not far from the OSU campus. Thank you for putting this on, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, and I hope to see all of you out here sometime in the future.
That's the third Wednesday of every month, a free organ performance here. I would say absolutely worth it. I feel like the first one I came to was in a past life, maybe about 10 years ago, but definitely looking forward to catching some of the music today.
So long, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Hansen on the organ, playing at the Wednesday free organ concerts that are presented on the third Wednesday of every month at the Corvallis United Methodist Church. There's more information at their website, corvallisfumc.org. That was recorded on the third Wednesday of this past October at 12:15 p.m. Just a reminder that as of Saturday night, we are observing daylight savings time. In the spring, we spring forward. In the fall back an hour. So if you have not done so already, remember to set your watch or your clock back 1 hour. Despite the Sunshine Protection Act being unanimously approved by the U.S. Senate in 2022, there is currently no permanent end in sight to daylight savings time. Do remember to set your clocks or watch an hour back if you have not done so already. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Monday, November 4th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be having a meeting at the downtown fire station in the council's chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for more details. On Wednesday, November 6th at 6:30 p.m., the Planning Commission will be conducting an online-only meeting. More information, including on how to join the meeting, at CorvallisOregon.gov. Also on Wednesday, November 6th, but at 6:30 p.m., the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library Advisory Board will be meeting at the Philomath Community Library, 1050 Applegate Street, as well as online. See CorvallisOregon.gov for more information. On Thursday, November 7th at 10 a.m., the Downtown Parking Task Force will be meeting virtually via Zoom. See CorvallisOregon.gov for more details, including how to join. Also on November 7th, but at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be having a work session that will be held both virtually as well as in person. The in-person location will be at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
This is Phil Farrell for KORC. Now, recently did an interview with Dr. Roxanne Manning after a conversation and book discussion on how to have anti-racist conversations. This took place in Corvallis at the Book Bin on October 17th, 2024.
Hey, this is Phil Farrell for KORC, and I'm here today at the Book Bin with a special guest speaker. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Roxy Manning.
And could you explain to the listeners what the topic of discussion was for today?
Sure. I've written two books, How to Have Anti-Racist Conversations and The Anti-Racist Heart. And so we were talking about how we could respond to racism in a way that builds connection, builds community, rather than divides us.
Okay. What would you say is the easiest way to start a conversation like that?
Well, it depends on whether or not you received the act of racism or if you did it. Right? Mm. So if you were the target of an act of racism, you can start by just saying, I want to pause. You know, that had an impact. And then really focus in and check in with yourself. Do you want to have this conversation with the person? Because sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't feel safe. And if you don't, I like to tell people it's okay not to. If you do want to have the conversation with the person, be really clear about what it is that they did that was hard for you. And then let them know, what was that like for you? You know, what impact did it have? And what would you like to see them do differently?
Okay. So there was that part where we were talking about excluding. Who do you want to exclude from your
beloved community?
From your community, beloved community. And you kind of answered it, but my question was, should we judge them just based on their overall group or label, or should we wait till they do something specific to react?
Well, Absolutely. I don't believe we should judge anybody based on any aspect of their identity, mm-hmm. whatever group that they belong to. For me, it's always about how do you show up and how are you treating me in this moment? And if you do something that's hard for me, if you do something that is costly, like we talked, for instance, in this talk about a capitalist who might be buying up land and displacing people, mm-hmm. right? I'm not judging the person just because they're capitalists. I'm judging them because of the impact of their actions. Mm-hmm. And so it's about how do I talk to you about the harm that you're causing in a way that lets you know I still value you and I still see your humanity, but that is willing to set a boundary to keep other people safe, keep other people housed.
Okay. And then just to let the listeners know, you grew up in Trinidad, correct?
Well, I was born in Trinidad. I came to the United States when I was 7.
Okay. And then from there, you moved to Harlem, correct?
Correct. I grew up in Harlem, New York.
And what was the culture shock like first coming to America?
Yeah, I think part of the culture shock for me was the difference between what race looks like in the two places. Trinidad is 40% black, mm-hmm. and we had one of the first, our first prime minister was a black person compared to the United States, where we just had our first black president, right? And so there's a difference in how accepted people feel, what kinds of opportunities you have available to you that I think my parents didn't know when they chose to come to the United States. Mm. They immigrated here because they said this is a place where our kids could get a great education. And they didn't realize the impact, for instance, of racism on our access to education. Mm. So part of the difference was in what opportunities were available to you and how you were seen just based on the color of your skin.
Okay. I can kind of relate because my mom's side, and me included, we were born in Hawaii. And mm-hmm. My dad's from Oregon. So over there, even though I'm very light, you know, I'm used to being around majority dark and multiracial people, and coming to Oregon, it's very much opposite, and yeah. it's almost like a dual reality kind of that I've had to deal with. And mm-hmm. I know you've mentioned your kids were mm-hmm. biracial. Mm-hmm. Have they brought that up at all? Kind of
yeah.
trying to find what side to identify, or kind of live in that dual yeah. reality kind
of. I think part of it for me with my children, who, as you mentioned, are biracial, was helping them realize that they didn't have to choose, right? Mm. Like this idea that you need to be Hawaiian or you're Oregonian, it's about how people see you, but you don't have to buy into that. And you could say, yeah, there are parts of me that really value and embrace this part of my culture, and there are parts of me that embrace this part of this culture, and other people can choose how they relate to you, but you get to choose how you want to be.
Mm. So, yeah. Great, I like that. I also like the part where, how you said we're all the same, but we also need to acknowledge that we're all different. And yeah. I've actually mentioned that on air before, and that's something I really appreciate and agree with. And
thank you. I think there's something really sad when I find people who are liberal, who are really wanting to like build the better world, the world that I want, say that the way that we do that is we erase differences, right? Mm-hmm. That we just say, you're just human. And I'm like, absolutely, I am just human, mm-hmm. but I'm a human being who experiences racism, who experiences sexism. And if you can't acknowledge that, if you can't see that, then I don't have a place to go to get support. So it's how do we do both? You fully see my humanity and you support me in the places where the world treats us as different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when you learn more cultures, you can pick up on little things, and it makes it easier to kind of talk to everybody, and then we realize we are the same. But yeah, we need mm-hmm. to I agree, embrace our differences and just kind of be ourselves. And I really like this whole speech. I'm kind of new to the nonviolent communications. I'm more brought in for the racial aspect, but mm-hmm. I think it all works together. And is there anything you want to say on that aspect, on the
sure.
nonviolent?
Well, nonviolent communication for me, I love it because just like when I got into it, it wasn't at all about the racism. It was around how can I hold myself with compassion, be a little bit more gentle to myself, and how can I raise my children in ways that help them know that they're fully accepted and belong. And it has so much gifts to how we address racism and other kinds of isms in the world that it's about how do we support people into being able to talk about the difficult things in ways that, like I said, bring us together, don't divide us. So if people are new to nonviolent communication, I know that there are groups in Corvallis and in Salem and in other places that are doing this. So, you know, go out there and learn about it. It's really transformative.
Okay. And then you want to just mention the book that you were out here with?
Sure. The book that I was doing the talk on today is How to Have Anti-Racist Conversations, Embracing Our Full Humanity to Challenge White Supremacy. And you can buy it at the Book Bin. Support your local bookstore.
Yes. Thank you to the Book Bin for hosting this event. And is there anywhere else people could maybe reach out, find you online somewhere?
Absolutely. My website is my name, RoxanneManning.com. And you can find me there. I also have a podcast on antiracistconversations.com. You can find the books, you can find the podcast, and more about me.
Oh, wow. Great. Thank you. Anything else you want to say? This has been a great speech, great conversation.
No, I'm just actually appreciating you for showing up and being interested in this. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Once again, that was an interview with Dr. Roxy Manning after her book discussion on how to have anti-racist conversations. This is Phil Farrell for KORC 105.9. Keep it tuned. Thank you.
It's Lava Lamp Larry, and police have identified a suspect behind the ballot drop box fires in Washington and Oregon, and say that he may be planning more attacks. The Portland police said in a press conference the other day that investigators believe the man who set two ballot boxes afire, one in Portland and one in Vancouver, Washington, using incendiary devices, that this person has a wealth of experience in metal fabrication and welding. They did not name a suspect. The Associated Press, another official told the Associated Press that the devices that blew up the two ballot boxes had the message "Free Gaza" on them. The New York Times, also citing an anonymous law enforcement officer, reported officials are trying to determine if the suspect is a pro-Palestinian activist or someone attempting to sow discord. The boxes caught on fire a week ago after the suspect stuck an incendiary device to the outside of them, officials said, adding the incidents were very similar to another event that happened earlier in October. 475 ballots were destroyed from the ballot box in Vancouver, according to Clark County Auditor Greg Kimsey. Most ballots in the Portland box survived the fire. Officials reported to that ballot box fire around 3:30 a.m. local time last Monday. And another ballot box at a park and ride station in Vancouver was set on fire around 4 a.m. Officials said the last time ballots had been picked up from that Vancouver box was Saturday at 11 a.m. and encouraged anyone who dropped a ballot off after that time to contact the Clark County Elections Office. The Portland box had fire suppressant inside the ballot box that protected virtually all the ballots, according to Multnomah County Elections Director Tim Scott, stating that only three ballots were damaged. A similar incident, which police believe may be related, took place in Vancouver on October 8th, but no ballots were damaged then. The Washington Republican Party said in a statement posted to X, formerly Twitter, that local Democratic leaders responded to the incident too late and did too little. The Oregon Republican Party said the incident was reason to support a return to in-person voting and served as evidence of a need to restore order on the streets of Oregon and to prosecute crime, not coddle criminals. Though neither Washington nor Oregon are swing states, the Washington area with the burn ballot box has a tight congressional race. It's a rematch of the 22 race between Republican candidate Joe Kent and incumbent Democratic Rep. Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. As of mid-October, polling showed the two tied with 46% support, according to Oregon Public Broadcasting. In response to the ballot box fire, Glusenkamp-Perez issued a statement saying, "There's absolutely zero place in our democracy for political violence or interference against our fellow citizens, election workers, or voting infrastructure." Kent posted a video on X in which he encouraged people who dropped their ballots in that box to check the ballot status and said he condemned the attacks against the democratic process. Well, nice to hear a Republican is in favor of a democratic process. The Oregon Democratic Party has arranged to have ballot box observers in place on election night. That's Tuesday night, November 5th. Election night between approximately 7 and 8:30 p.m. to observe last-minute drop-offs and make sure that those ballots are secure. Let me give you a list of where the ballot drop boxes are in Benton County. This is the best place to put your ballot if you have not yet sent it in. Do not mail it. It will probably not arrive on time. But you can drop your ballot at the Kalapuya Building on Research Way in Southwest Corvallis, in front of Gill Coliseum on the OSU campus, at the Lincoln Health Center, right off Highway 99 or South 3rd Street and Viewmont in Corvallis, the Law Enforcement Building on 5th Street downtown, in front of the Benton County Courthouse on 4th Street downtown, in front of the Corvallis Public Library, 6th Street and Monroe in Corvallis, the LBCC Benton Center on Polk Avenue right off 9th Street in Corvallis, the Corvallis Community Center on Tyler, that's near Harrison, and the Wells Fargo Bank at the Timber Hill Shopping Center, Kings and Walnut, the North Albany Shopping Center on Hickory Avenue, Adair Village's City Hall on William R. Carr Avenue, and in Corvallis also on Highway 99 West at the City Limits Market, the Philomath County Library in Philomath, the Monroe Community Library, and the Alsea Community Library. The most important thing is vote by Tuesday, November 5th. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. Thanks for joining us today. By now, you've probably received your ballot in the mail. Perhaps you've even filled it out and mailed it out or dropped it at a ballot drop box. But as I record this on Thursday of this past week, I am joined here at the Benton County Kalapuya Building by James Morales, who is a county clerk and records and elections director for Benton County. We are also joined today by Ann Thwaites of the Board of Commissioners Office and the current serving public information officer for Benton County. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you for being here, Dan.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you today.
We're just going to have a brief conversation because, as I mentioned, most people have probably received their ballots in the mail by now. But at this point in the game, with the election being just days away, what if someone has not received their ballot in the mail yet?
Well, any voter who has been inactivated or has not received their ballot for one reason or another has up until 8 p.m. on election day to come into our office here at the Kalapuya Building to receive their ballot and cast their vote.
We should quickly mention, what is the location of the Kalapuya Building?
We're at 4500 Southwest Research Way.
In Southwest Corvallis, just off Philomath Boulevard a bit. If someone wants to check their voter eligibility status, is there a website they can go to?
There is a website. They can go to our website, which is on the county pages. It's rebentoncountyor.gov, and then go to the elections link and you can go and check your vote on My Vote, which is on the state website, but we have a link to it from there.
And for listeners who have received their ballot and maybe haven't sent it in yet, is it quicker to put it into an official ballot box, or is the mail a good idea at this point with the election being so close away?
Well, we have ballot pickup teams going out to our drop sites. We have 15 sites throughout the county. We recommend using those sites at this point in the process.
I dropped my ballot off at the Benton County Courthouse earlier this week, and I did notice it was a very secure box. And something that I've been a little concerned about, having heard the news that there's some voter sabotage happening with some of the arsons up in Multnomah County as well as Washington.
Yeah, ballot security at our drop sites is a primary concern and consideration that we take whenever we place a drop box in any location. We want it to be visible and secure, and so we take those measures.
Is there anything you'd like the voters to know, maybe somebody who has not filled out their ballot yet?
Well, I just want to encourage them. My vote by mail is a great process that allows them time to consider their choices carefully before returning the ballot, so they still have time to do that. We've got voter pamphlets out. If they can't find their voter's pamphlet, we have those available on our website as well, which I've already provided, and hopefully you can also share that with your listeners. And just to get those to those drop sites, that's going to be our primary recommendation. You can still return it by the mail. It's postage paid, postmarks count, and we give it up until 1 week after Election Day for any postmarked ballots to be returned to us.
And, of course, listeners should remember to sign the back of their ballot.
Great point, Dan. I really appreciate you bringing that up. So, yes, please sign your ballot. Anyone who fails to do so or whose signature maybe is changing and does not match, we send out a letter to all those voters, and they are given up to 3 weeks after the election to come into our office and resolve that challenged ballot with us and still have their vote counted.
Can you explain ranked choice voting? It's something that I feel like it was maybe appeared for the first time on the last ballot that I filled out. And I know that there's actually a measure for, I believe it's measure 117, to make ranked choice voting a statewide reality.
Sure, I can do. I can try. Over the radio, it's not easy. So ranked choice voting, I believe what we've adopted here in Benton County is probably the simplest version that can be adopted. And that was really the goal when I was working with those that were proposing bringing the measure forward to the Benton County voters. Is I asked them, can we please keep this simple so that we're able to implement it well and explain it to the voters in a manner in which we would be successful, because I didn't think it would be a good idea to make it too complicated coming out of the gate and could have a potential for failure. So I think we were successful in doing that. They were able to give us the funding in order to develop some educational materials. We have those available on our website. Subsequently, the city of Corvallis adopted ranked choice voting for their city positions, mayor and the councilors. And so anytime we have three or more candidates file for one of those positions, whether it's commissioner or the Corvallis positions, then that contest then qualifies on the general election ballot to be a ranked choice contest. And what the voters need to probably know when they're voting a ranked choice contest is that their first choice ranking is going to be, the primary vote that's going to be displayed throughout the process. But we won't be running the final tally of the ranked choice voting round by round results until we have all the ballots in. And that includes that resolution period where any challenged signatures, voters still have the opportunity, or postmarked ballots that we're waiting to receive are made part of the tally, because we don't want to eliminate any candidate as we're displaying results prematurely. We want to make sure we wait till we get the entire aggregate of those votes in to run the round-by-round ranked choice voting process to display and show how, you know, candidates with the lowest amount of votes are the first eliminated candidates, and the second choices on those ballots for the eliminated candidate are the ones that are transferred to the remaining candidates in the contest.
So what if it was a landslide election? Would there still be this consideration put in place?
So the moment one candidate receives over 50% of the votes that are being tallied, whether it's in the first round or a subsequent round, that candidate is then declared the winner, and we stop processing the ranked choice.
We are joined by James Morales, who is the Records and Election Director for Benton County. And as we mentioned, and as you probably already know, Election Day is Tuesday. If you're listening on Sunday, that's just 2 days away. Maybe you're listening to the repeat of KORC News, Music, and Civics on Monday evening. Remember to get your ballots in and get them signed. And is there anything else you'd like to leave the voters with?
I just really want to let the voters know that we appreciate how well, you know, Benton County voters have always turned out, and we're looking at a pretty good turnout this time around. So encourage our voters to participate in the process. We're here to make sure it's secure and counted accurately.
I should ask, generally, what is the participation rate in Benton County with voters?
Yeah, for a presidential contest, we typically get over 80%, sometimes even close to 85 or 90% in Benton County.
Is that considered high according to the national average?
It is considered very high according to the national average, and also usually one of the higher turnout rates in Oregon.
Thanks for joining us today, and thank you for your time, Mr. Morales.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share all this information with our voters.
And we should also thank Ann Thwaites of the Board of Commissioners Office and the current Public Information Officer for Benton County for being here today.
Thank you, Dan. We're always happy to have an opportunity to talk about this very important process.
If you'd like to find out more, you can visit bentoncountyor.gov. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. Michael Moore has a message to non-voters, and it goes as follows. You, my friends, are the biggest and most powerful political party in America. It's true. It's not the Republicans or the Democrats. It's the non-voters. Take a look at these numbers. In 2020, 66.8% of Americans 18 and older came out to vote. That means two-thirds of us voted and one-third did not, right? Let me put it in a different way for you. The following are the election results for 2020 based on the popular vote. First place, Democrats for Joe Biden, 81 million votes. Second place, non-voters, 80 million votes. Third place, Republicans, Donald Trump, 74 million votes. You guys have more votes than Donald Trump. And in 2016, your non-voting party performed even better. First place, non-voters, 100 million votes. Second place, Democrats, Hillary Clinton, 65 million votes. Third place, Republicans, Donald Trump, 62 million votes. Non-voters are not powerless. You have all the power. You are the most powerful political force in America, and what you choose to do with that power will define the course of history for this country. Because here's the thing. Every day, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, politics makes decisions that affect your life. Having to pay off student loan debt well into your 50s and 60s equals politics. Being forced to drive 8 hours to another state to get life-saving medical care after a miscarriage equals politics. The federal minimum wage staying at $7.25 an hour equals politics. Your grocery bill skyrocketing because companies are allowed to jack up prices without oversight equals politics. Receiving a letter from the National Guard, which you only joined to help pay for college, saying that you are now being deployed to die in an unnecessary war in a faraway land equals politics. Maybe that's why some people in the media and in the political parties disparage you, because they're afraid of what you might do if you start paying attention to politics. They are afraid of what you are capable of. You've got the power and you have the leverage. These are the issues that I believe truly matter to you and your family. 1. Only women have the right to control their bodies. 2. Tax the rich. 3. Ban assault weapons. 4. Everyone should be able to afford their own home. 5. Double or triple the minimum wage. 6. Stop corporate price gouging. 7. Ceasefire in Gaza. 8. expand Obamacare. 9, expand Social Security and Medicare. 10, cover at-home care for seniors. 11, child tax credit. 12, let workers join a union. 13, paid family and medical leave. Can I ask that you do a favor for me? Vote. It is really that important to me. There is, honestly, too large of a part of me that believes we may be truly at our end. I really won't bother you for anything else, but I will remember that you did something that you really didn't want to do, and that you did it for the rest of us. Thank you for the selfless act, my friend. Signed, Michael Moore. You just heard a piece by Michael Moore to non-voters, and you're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
KORC recently had a chance to sit down with Kirsten Miller, president of the Ten Rivers Food Web, a local volunteer-run organization that works to connect people who eat food with small to medium-sized food producers in Linn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. Let's see what she had to say about their efforts.
We're here with Kirsten Miller with Ten Rivers Food Web, who's going to tell us about their role in the community's local food networks. So, Kirsten, I was just wondering if you could sort of give us a brief history about how Ten Rivers Food Web started, if there was some other efforts around local food at the time that led to that, and how the organization serves the community today.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So Ten Rivers has been around since 2005 and started as conversations in church halls, truly, around the shortage and the challenges of food security and food access. And over the years, the nonprofit has taken on numerous different programs, gone in a lot of different directions. At this time, what we are doing, we have two standard annual events that are our cornerstones. One is Fill Your Pantry, which is coming up on November 3rd, this Sunday, from 12 to 3 at the fairgrounds, Benton County Fairgrounds. And that is a bulk buying event. And the opportunity there is for the community to stock up on local food as we come into the winter season, when there are fewer farmers markets and opportunities to buy local. And it helps all the producers, because the farmers and ranchers can clear out their barns and freezers and have the community doing the storage themselves. So that's one of our events. We also have a soil amendment sale. It is an online sale in January. It's also about bulk buying. We aggregate all the orders together, and folks can access bulk pricing. And then it's a drive-through format in March, and you just come to the fairgrounds, and we load up your vehicle, and you take your amendments away for your backyard garden or homestead or small farm. In addition to those two events, we also launched a online local food directory in June, and you can find that on our website. You can find that at www.oregontaste.com/TRFW for Ten Rivers Food Web. And that can help you connect with local producers, again, ranchers, orchards, fisheries, and help you locate where you could find food. And all of those programs, even though the two events are held in Benton County, we do serve the 10 rivers that goes all the way from the Cascades to the ocean.
So do you know them off the top of your head?
I do not. That's a good question. Nobody's actually challenged me on that.
Well, it never hurts to look at a map and remind yourself of your local geography.
True. So the counties then are for Lynn, right. Benton, and Lincoln counties. We have a lot of folks that come in from all over in order to purchase for those events, and all of those communities are represented in the producers that are that you could find on the directory at OregonTaste.com. In addition to that, we're working on a new effort, which will be a food hub located in South Corvallis. It's called the Mid Valley Food Hub. And that will be a local aggregation and distribution warehouse, also for bulk ordering. So we'll have an online marketplace where folks can order likely in quantities that are either 5 pounds or up to a case at a time. So that might work for someone that wants to buy for their family, a larger family, or they could do a local buying club with other families together that also can serve restaurants and caterers in our community or other institutions, schools as well.
It sounds like you're trying to move or expand beyond the sort of weekend trip to the farmer's market for a snack and connect people with a deeper kind of relationship to their whole diet, maybe, with local food networks. Is that fair?
Yeah, we're trying to help people be able to access more local food and to ensure that we have a robust local food system. And okay. So, yes, we absolutely support the farmers market and the work that that does. And we're trying to not we're trying to add to that what is already available in the community by adding new programming or additional programs that aren't competing with, but giving farmers another point of sale and also eaters and community members another place to be able to access local food if they're not available on a Sunday morning or a Saturday morning to go to the local market.
Yeah. That's great information for anybody who's trying to get connected to those networks. Do you have anything else to say sort of about just zooming out a little bit about the philosophy again of how this type of food economy can fit into the life of a community and the lives of individuals? Because that's a deliberate choice on the part of consumers away from the corporate supply chains. Do you guys have any thoughts on the economic, environmental, conservation-related issues that process addresses?
Yeah. In the audience of producers that we work with, we don't have a list of you need to be or you can't be's. That said, the more local your food is, whether it be organic or not, whether it be certified or not, it has a climate change impact in terms of traveling fewer miles. It has a impact in terms of nutrition because the food hasn't sat around as long. It has a relational impact because you know where it's coming from and you feel connected to it. You likely value what has become cheap food in our community, and because you see what effort goes into actually growing that food. And I don't want to just brush off, there's a real economic challenge in that. So it is not cheap to buy local food because people are paid for their time more fairly. And they're compensated hopefully better. It's not always the case. There are a lot of farmers that are very close to margins as well. But it tightens that loop of knowing and awareness that is really important. And And hopefully we can be working with this food hub, because it's bulk buying, on the accessibility piece of things, that, you know, we want the farmers to also be paid enough. And we also want to make sure that more people can actually afford local food. So that's something that we're working on. There are potential for a grant there, grants to help do price supports, because it's not just about education. I think people know they want good, healthy food, and we need to find a way to actually make that possible.
I've heard of studies about local food networks, and I think average incomes and some health metrics were actually raised in communities that were studied with deliberate food, local food programs.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm not articulating that very
clearly. No, that's okay. And I don't really have stats on that.
No,
I'm not
a
good stats person. But
for people who just think there's no real long-term access to local food networks, I think some studies have shown that... Big surprise. It's actually good for communities.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, because it's about the local economy. This isn't just about local food. If you're buying local food, that's about the local food economy.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got a lot of growers that are trucking all the way up to Portland to sell their food, because that's where they feel like they can access more people. And
there is sort of a cultural notion, I think, that eating locally, buying locally is always more expensive. You know, it's inaccessible to average people. It's only for, you know, people with more money. Whereas it seems like your organization's trying to bridge that gap, both mentally and materially.
Yeah, I mean, that's the foundation of, you know, bulk, right?
Mm.
You know, rather than you buying one onion, you're buying 20 pounds of onions and you're storing them. Now, you're not getting them cheap, you know, it still needs to be enough for the farmer, but it's cheaper to buy in bulk, just like it's cheaper if you are buying part of an animal, because then it's very simple. Then the producer, they don't have to sit there and, you know, find each individual customer for each, pound of meat or each pound of squash that they're selling.
Right.
So the more product that they can move with the least amount of effort can help keep down the cost, because they're not sitting there using their time in order to make that happen.
And I think those intermediary steps in the life of, you know, a food product is something that's out of sight, out of mind for a lot of people. And it's good to sit down and go through it sometimes. It's part of what we're trying to bring people in the radio. I just wanted to ask, if there was anything else about 10 Rivers Food Web and the other organizations you help with, if there was anything else you wanted to share about that. And I was just curious how you got involved in this line of work and this role in the community.
Yeah, so I came to local food through school gardens in Northern California. I was a school garden teacher for a handful of years, and I saw the value of kids, but it's not just kids, people growing their own food. And the kids' willingness, interest, enthusiasm to try new foods because they had grown it. And it wasn't just growing food that we did. We also brought the classroom or the state curriculum out into the garden. So they were doing measuring, they were doing biology, they were doing language arts, we would do writing, and inspired by being in a place and in the garden and eating and growing food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I came to local food and my passion for it. In terms of 10 Rivers and the last kind of things that I would say, we value how we operate. I think that's something that makes us unique and special. For instance, we're an all-volunteer organization at this time. That will likely be changing come January with the food hub. But it's important to us that the people that are involved are getting something out of it, that it's not just like us bleeding dry because we have good, big, generous hearts, but that you are doing things that you enjoy, you're doing things that you're passionate about, that you're doing things that you're good at, or something that you want to learn, and that it's feeding you as well. And I think that that's like, that is, speaks to how much we focus on the relationships of the people that volunteer with us in the organizations that we partner with, and the connections that we aim to make with, the, you know, farmers and ranchers and fishers, apiarists, and also the community of eaters.
Well, from one local volunteer-run organization to the next, thank you, Kirsten Miller. Thank you for talking with KORC about Ten Rivers Food Web and the role that you serve in the community.